Jesus replied, "Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." Another disciple said to him, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." But Jesus told him, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." Then he got into the boat and his disciples followed him. Suddenly, a furious storm came up on the lake so that the waves swept over the boat, but Jesus was sleeping. The disciples went and woke him, saying, "Lord, save us, we're going to drown." He replied, "You have little faith. Why are you so afraid?" Then he got up and rebuked the winds and the waves, and it was completely calm. The men were amazed and asked, "What kind of man is this? Even the winds and the waves obey him." During Jesus' ministry, there were very few prominent people, you may have noticed, who followed him. And so we might think that Jesus would have been honored by this teacher of the law. Older versions call them scribes, who wants to follow him. Now, at this point in Matthew's telling of the story of Jesus, there have not yet been any Pharisees and teachers of the law attacking him as a false teacher. You got to keep Matthew's order of things here in mind. They haven't appeared yet. He's not yet exposed them as hypocrites. The only thing that he has said about them so far could almost be taken as a compliment. Back in the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 5, he said, "For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, I said it could almost be taken as a compliment because he is sort of calling them righteous. You know, they have to be righteous. They have to have righteousness in order for the righteousness of others to surpass their righteousness, right? But this teacher of the law responds to Jesus' teaching in a way that actually everyone should respond to Jesus' teaching. He obviously believes that Jesus is the best teacher that he has ever heard, and he is claiming to be devoted to him. But this is really not about the teacher of the law. We don't even know what he did after Jesus said this. You know, maybe he followed Jesus. Maybe he decided not to. I think we read back into this incident all of the very disappointing responses of other teachers of the law, and we just assume that there's no way that he followed Jesus after what Jesus said. But we don't really know that. And I guess we don't need to know that. What we do need to know is that Jesus did not sugarcoat the choice that he had to make. Some of you heard this about my brother's Navy experience. Back in the late 60s, when we were involved in the Vietnam War, my older brother was about to be drafted into the Army. My dad thought that the Navy might be a safer option, and so they went to a Navy recruiter. Well, it so happened that my brother had worked two summers as a machinist making parts for Boeing's 747s. They were brand new at the time. But the recruiter told him that that would be a ticket into Navy machinist school for sure, and he'd never see any of the less pleasant duties that many sailors would be subject to. Well, you might guess what actually happened. He ended up in what was called the hole of a battleship, many regarded as the worst job in the Navy, working on the engines way below deck. And while they were offshore near Vietnam, he suffered dehydration from the extreme heat, almost died because his veins collapsed and they couldn't get an IV working. Now, I'll give the recruiter the benefit of the doubt and allow for the possibility that he believed what he said would happen. But one thing that recruiters are notorious for is doing their best to highlight the best things that could happen and minimize the risks, right? Well, whether they are as guilty as their reputation or not, we don't expect them to do the opposite, do we? I mean, we don't expect them to highlight the risks and minimize the opportunities. Now, remember the mindset of the Jews of Jesus' day. They didn't see the Messiah, the Christ, as a spiritual leader without an army to back him up. They expected him to have an army, like King David. If Jesus was the Messiah, he should be recruiting an army. And that's actually what his disciples will think that they're doing when he sends them out. Spiritual authority was essential in their expectations, but military force would be necessary as well. So Jesus was working against himself as a recruiter with this teacher. I mean, he was highlighting the downsides of joining his army instead of promising glory and honor. But with this man in particular, those around Jesus were probably especially shocked by Jesus' response. Here was a teacher of the law who had studied the law and the prophets for years and was a recognized authority, promising to be Jesus' follower. Jesus should have been honored, everyone would have thought. Maybe they even thought that Jesus should honor the teacher of the law like he had honored the faith of the centurion. Remember last week who asked him to heal his servant a few verses earlier. So maybe there would even be some way to make special accommodations for such an important person. You know, maybe he could be on reserve duty so he could still live in his comfortable house and maintain his respected roles in his own hometown and just join Jesus when it was convenient to him. You know, to be fair to the man, though, he did not ask for any special consideration. And we don't know that he went away sad like a rich young man will in chapter 19. What he did after Jesus said this does not matter to us at all. What matters to us is what we will do when we are faced with choosing between following a difficult choice that we know that Jesus would have made, or choosing the way that is easier in the short run. Again, as we saw last week, following Jesus is not the easy way. There are lots of choices in life that seem like they lead down paths that will make our lives better, but we know that Jesus would have taken a completely different route. You know, they lead to one or more of the big three, you know, money, power, or pleasure. Well, for Jesus, this man could have been a part of the temptation to bow down and worship Satan when Satan offered him power over all the kingdoms of the world if he would bow down to him. Jesus did not take the bait. Well, we need to not take the bait. We need to know that those temptations will come and that we are signing on to follow him down the path to the cross before we ever join him at the throne of glory. That doesn't mean that there are no times of joy and rejoicing along the way. In fact, Jesus will be accused of being a party animal because he joins in at feasts and celebrations and his followers don't fast. But he doesn't make his choices based on what is most fun at the moment. And that's what we can't do either. Maybe the best choice is sometimes the most fun, or at least the most joyful. But we don't make our choices based on that. We don't make our choices because they're the most fun. We do what we do because it is best for others. Now, that's always actually less painful in the long run, but it's only sometimes less painful at the moment that we make the choices. Sometimes it's very hard and very unpleasant and very unpopular. Now, the next guy is faced with an even more shocking challenge, I think. He said, "First, let me go and bury my father." But Jesus told him, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." Now, we do need to understand that the man was not just asking for a few days off for the funeral. His father was not yet dead. "I must first bury my father" was actually a phrase that was used to say that a son must stay and work with his father until his father died. So that could be months, but it most likely would be years. So it was the duty of a devoted son. He didn't say this, but burying your father was a part of what it traditionally meant to honor your father and mother, as the commandment said. And so that was kind of what the young man was saying. Well, how could Jesus not honor that? Well, we could soften Jesus' answer by suggesting that Jesus was just affirming that those who die are not alone and the dead can take care of them. okay? Those who have gone before are there to welcome them and honor their lives, and that's true. It's somewhat comforting, but I doubt that anyone who heard Jesus say this would have taken it that way. Jesus seems to be deliberately using very provocative language. He's actually now the one who is speaking in the way that we might only think is acceptable in times of active war. Under normal life conditions, honoring your father and mother might come first, at least until you have a wife and children of your own, but it should remain near the very first priority in your life, if possible, even when you have a wife and children. It's very disappointing to me to see adult children failing or even refusing to do whatever they can to take care of their parents and bring them as much joy as possible. I know of one family with three adult children and three adult grandchildren whose father and grandfather has dementia that has resulted in several severe health challenges. And his wife is in her 80s and has some health issues as well. But all of his care falls on her. All but one of the children and the grandchildren live within 5 miles of them, but they rarely visit. They do not offer any relief for even a few hours for his wife to go while they take care of him. They rarely call to talk to him. Even short visits are even more rare. They celebrate holidays and birthdays in their own homes, rather than bringing the joy to him and his wife. That is not right. This is a violation of a commandment that should be taken seriously. Honor your father and your mother. Now, there are some parents who make it nearly impossible to have a good relationship, and some situations in life that make it nearly impossible to do much for your parents. And God will forgive us if we fail in that relationship, just as he'll forgive us when we fail in other relationships. But we do need to, when we failed, start over and do our best to love others in our family and outside our family in the spirit of Christ after we've been forgiven for our failures, right? Does anyone doubt that this is consistent with Jesus' life and teachings? Well, of course it is. So how could Jesus say what he said to this disciple? This was a man who is claiming to be a follower of Jesus already. Notice that another disciple said to him, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." As I suggested, Jesus is actually now the one who is speaking the way that we might think is only acceptable in times of active wars. During times of war, men and women and families are sometimes forced to suspend the normal rules and live under a different set of priorities. And to a certain extent, active duty and even reserve soldiers and National Guard soldiers, you may have noticed in the past few years, have been subject to a different set of priorities. Soldiers do not get to choose whether they make all of the family birthdays or make all of the holidays or even funerals. They can ask for leave if they're not deployed overseas, but it's really not up to them. And those who are left behind when a soldier goes to war have to find ways to manage the things that would normally be the responsibility of that soldier. Right, Derek? I believe that those who heard Jesus say this very likely had to know that he could only be saying this as a way of saying that if you sign on to follow me, you're signing up for wartime priorities. You may even be prevented from keeping some of the commandments at times, but those you leave behind will manage without you. Now, this is ironic, and it'll become confusing as he works to bring them to a new understanding of the nature of the kingdom. But it is possible that at this point, in the early stages of his ministry, as Matthew lays it out, this was less surprising to his followers than we might think. They were definitely thinking that a war was imminent and that they would be fighting in it. They may very well have heard these words as the words of a commander who expected his soldiers to give their full allegiance to him while the war was on. Thinking of Uriah the Hittite, who left his wife Bathsheba behind when David sinned with her, and then he brought him back, And he wouldn't even sleep with Bathsheba because he was so dedicated to his king and to the war that his king had sent him to. So if we are choosing Jesus, we choose to obey and follow him, holding nothing back. The next story is a familiar story that we find in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Then he got into the boat and his disciples followed him. Suddenly a furious storm came up on the lake so that the waves swept over the boat. But Jesus was sleeping. The disciples went and woke him, saying, "Lord, save us. We're going to drown." He replied, "You of little faith, why are you so afraid?" Then he got up and rebuked the winds and the waves, and it was completely calm. The men were amazed and asked, "What kind of man is this? Even the winds and the waves obey him." This may seem to be moving on to something unrelated to those two stories about the challenges of following Jesus. But let's look a little more closely. Start with that first line, "Then he got into the boat and his disciples followed him." This line, did I put that up there? Yeah. This line follows the last verse, the last line in verse 22. But Jesus told this man, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." So Matthew started telling about Jesus' followers in chapter 4 when he called Peter, Andrew, James, and John out of their fishing boats to follow him. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter, and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. "Come, follow me," Jesus said, "and I will send you out to fish for people." At once they left their nets and followed him. Going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They were in a boat with their father Zebedee, preparing their nets. Jesus called them, and immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. Notice, James and John got out of their boat and left their father. They did not say, "First, we must bury our father." They followed. Now, in chapter 8, they follow Jesus onto a boat. They still do not understand a lot about Jesus' mission, but they do understand that this is a man that they should obey. The Sea of Galilee is actually what we would call a lake. It's only 13 miles long and about 8 miles wide. It's in the Jordan Valley. The Jordan River flows into it and out of it, so you could even say that it's really just a very wide section of the Jordan River. The Sea of Galilee is 680 feet below sea level, and so this gives it a nice climate of its own most of the time, but winds and storms can almost form immediately, very quickly, because the crevices around it can act like funnels and almost blow from all directions at once. So when they followed him onto the boat, they weren't being brave. It was calm at that time. They were just being loyal followers. Jesus was tired, and so he was asleep on a cushion when the storm came up. I'm guessing that it might not have been the fishermen who were so afraid. They were probably the only ones who were comfortable in a boat. I'm guessing they were trying to keep the boat from turning over. But most of the Jews were really just not very friendly with water. And so the other disciples were just frantic. After he asked his disciples why they have so little faith in God's plans that they think that he would let them all die in a storm before everything had been fulfilled, didn't say all of that, but that seems to me to be why he might have expected more faith. So he provides a demonstration then of more authority. Most versions say that he rebuked the winds and the waves, like the NIV that we just read. That could sound like he was saying, "How dare you frighten my poor little disciples?" No, I don't think so. I think the New Century Version actually has it right. Jesus got up and gave a command to the wind and the waves, and it became completely calm. This is about authority. What kind of leader do you want in a battle? Do you want a leader who has to ask his soldiers what they think they should do? One who needs a consensus before he will proceed? Might be good leadership in a business at times, but No, by the time you get a consensus in a war, you may all be dead. You want a leader who knows what he expects and has the authority to make it happen. By the way, we should remember the centurion's words in the story a few verses before. The centurion replied, "Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it." And then after Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law, notice what it says in verse 14, "When evening came, many who were demon-possessed were brought to him, and he drove out the spirits with a word." So as we saw last week, compassion and honor and fulfillment of prophecy were reasons behind Jesus' healings, but they also really were done to demonstrate his authority, especially the casting out of demons. And so as we have continued into the next encounters, we have seen the overarching theme of authority playing out. Now, King John in the clip was the king that Robin Hood rebelled against, and he attempted to assert his authority by virtue of his title as king. Well, that was the kind of authority that the Jews hated. They were hoping for a king who would be very different, and Jesus was very different. His authority was and is absolute, but he was and is anything but a tyrant. He used his authority to save people from illnesses and demonic powers that enslaved them, and that inspired people to follow him. But since he did not also promise lives free of conflict and persecution and all future suffering, not everyone remained loyal to their initial choice. So we must remain loyal to his authority. We must believe in his cause and not turn back, even when it seems like it's too much for us. And when we wonder how this could possibly be what God wants for his children. I think it's hard for us to imagine the kind of commitment to a cause that some have had in past generations. The Civil War was unbelievably brutal. Hundreds of thousands died in both battle and from diseases. The cause for one side was righteous, and for the other side it was not, but soldiers on both sides were incredibly committed to their cause as they understood it. Listen to this letter written by Major Sullivan Ballou of the Union Army to his wife, Sarah, a week before the Battle of Bull Run. They had been married only 6 years. "My very dear Sarah, the indications are very strong that we shall move in a few days, perhaps tomorrow. Lest I should not be able to write again, I feel impelled to write a few lines that may fall under your eye when I shall be no more. I have no misgivings about or lack of confidence in the cause in which I am engaged, and my courage does not halt or falter. I know how strongly American civilization now leans on the triumph of the government and how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and suffering of the revolution. And I am willing, perfectly willing, to lay down all my joys in this life to help maintain this government and to pay that debt. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence could break. And yet, my love for country comes over me like a strong wind and bears me irresistibly on with all these chains to the battlefield. The memories of all the blissful moments I've spent with you come creeping over me, and I feel most deeply grateful to God and you that I have enjoyed them so long. And how hard it is for me to give them up and burn to ashes the hopes of future years, when, God willing, we might still have lived and loved together and seen our sons grown up to honorable manhood around us. If I do not return, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I love you. And when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Forgive my many faults and the many pains I have caused you. How thoughtless, how foolish I have oftentimes been. Oh, Sarah, if the dead can come back to this earth and flit unseen around those they loved, I shall always be near you in the gladdest day and in the darkest night, amidst your happiest scenes and gloomiest hours, always, always. And if there be a soft breeze upon your cheek, it shall be my breath. Or the cool air cools your throbbing temple, it shall be my spirit passing by. Sarah, do not mourn me dead. Think I am gone, and wait for me, for we shall meet again. Major Ballou was killed 1 week later in the First Battle of Bull Run. And we can all wonder if he indeed did utter Sarah's name as he lay dying on the battlefield. Sometimes our suffering can be in a physical war that is brought on by a fight against evil, like slavery. But even if we are nowhere close to the kind of danger that soldiers face, the physical danger, there are evils that we all will face. The way of Jesus is not the easy way, but it is what Luke called in the book of Acts, the way. Before followers of Jesus were called Christians, they were called followers of the way. There is no other way to get to God, to where God wants us to be. He wants us to be with Him. He has adopted us as His children, and He wants the family to be together. His Son returned to Him through incredible suffering, and we will get there through suffering as well. Now, thankfully, that's not the whole story for most of us. Nothing but lives of suffering. You know, I told you about my brother's less than joyful experience in the Navy. Well, that was what happened during the first 2 years of his 4 years of service. Well, after that, they put his ship in mothballs, and he did get to go to Navy Machinist School. And his class was one of the Navy's best ever, and he was at the top of his class. And then he was assigned to a two-man machine shop in Hawaii under a boss who liked to get things done early every day. And my brother was an athlete, and he liked what we now call extreme sports. Didn't call them that back then. But he and his boss would go surfing. And then James, my brother, would go cliff diving sometimes. And there are even volcanic mountains on Hawaii high enough to snow ski. So at least once he went surfing and snow skiing on the same day. He loved it. So it wasn't all bad. God doesn't want us to suffer, but He does allow it. He does not want us to be deceived when we sign on to follow Jesus. He wants us to know that we can and we must endure any suffering that we face. He also wants us to live without fear of the winds and the waves. He wants us to live by faith in Him and His care for us. We choose to follow Him with our eyes open to the reality that we may be living in a tent while we're on this earth, but we have a home waiting for us in heaven that is unlike anything that we could live in on this earth. Let's pray together. Our Father, we are grateful.